Hey. ¿Qué pasó, everybody? You're listening to Expanded Perspectives with me, Cam Hale, also known as Speedy Gonzalez. And sitting across from me is Mr. Kyle Filson, also known as Slowpoke Rodriguez.
Hola, vato.
Happy Cinco de Mayo, everybody.
Yeah, how's everybody doing out there?
Oh, I hope everybody's doing great. Let's have us a good party today.
Yeah. Today we're going to talk about, has science figured out a way to win rock, paper, scissors?
Hell yeah.
And scientists discovered the Egyptian secret to moving the large stones.
That's right. And then we're going to do a little chatting with Mr. John Anthony West.
That's right.
The king of Egypt.
The one that first, you know, him and Robert Sharkey were the guys that first put forth that theory that the Sphinx is much older than traditional archaeologists say it is.
Yeah, and it was such a great time to talk to John. And it's one of those things I remember, like we talked about, you know, we watched it back when we were in high school. And that's kind of what led us down to where we are today.
Now, I think there's a new one out right now on Netflix. It's like a newer version of that documentary.
I believe so.
It's called Mysteries of the Sphinx. But yeah, it was like 1991 when I remember the first time it came out with Charlton Heston.
Yes.
Was commentating on there.
And Moses standing up there telling you about the age of the Sphinx.
Yep, and that was the first time I'd ever heard about water erosion on the Sphinx or anything about it, or that the possibility that it could be older. Not just older, but they know that wasn't the original face on it.
Yes.
It's the first time I heard all that. That blew me away. So now to be able to sit here and actually speak with John Anthony West, I mean, that blows my mind just to even say that.
And we also interviewed Robert Schock. He'll be coming up in the next couple of weeks. So we talked to him a few weeks prior to this show right here. So you get to talk to both of them about Egyptian history.
Right? And, I never thought we would have been able to do that.
Yeah. So it pretty much. So, okay, lay it on me, bro. I want to know about this rock, paper, scissors.
Okay, man. Have you ever played rock, paper, scissors when you were a kid?
Rochambeau, rock, paper, scissors. I'm a beast, Dad. Yeah,
tons of people have played
it. I'm a rock, paper, scissor manimal.
Well, apparently the Chinese are really fascinated with it, you know. And they did a collective group of researchers in China, took 360 students, and they broke them up into groups of six and had them play 300 rounds of the game in random pairings.
Okay.
To make sure that the players never lost their incentive or got bored, that they paid them some money. Now, it doesn't say what they paid them. But it doesn't matter. What do you need to know to win, right?
Yeah.
After observing the many, many rounds, the scientists found that if a player wins over their opponent in one play, their probability of repeating the same action in the next play is considerably higher than the probabilities of shifting actions.
So if I throw rock, I'm more likely to throw rock the next round.
That's what it's saying, right? It says, you know, if on the other hand, it says if a player loses two or more times in a row, he or she will more likely not play the same sign, but will instead shift to a different sign. So if player A has been on a losing streak and player B has just thrown down scissors to beat A's paper, they will likely next throw down a rock, and then it says that they stand a good chance of winning since B is likely to stick with the previously used hand. So there really is a strategy, and they found out that, you know, if you're winning and you're on a hot streak, you become more predictable, actually, because when you start losing, you automatically start second-guessing yourself and you start shifting the way you play, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
So if you break it down by the numbers, mathematically, you can win more often at rock, paper, scissors by watching really close on how the person's playing.
I love that that's what we're worried about in today's modern society is Rochambeau getting our rock, paper, scissors. That makes me laugh. It really is pretty funny.
It is funny, right?
It's like counting cards and blackjack or anything else. You know? Now you're like, I'm going to throw paper. And I know what move.
Oh, man. Now, if you're strategizing rock, paper, scissors, you obviously have a lot of free time. Too much free time.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. That's still a funny thing, though.
Yeah.
But you know what? I'm gonna try it out on my kids.
Yeah, I'm going to try it out on mine, too. Yeah. That sounds like fun.
I'm going to do it. We'll have to report on this next show. We'll have to give our kids a whirl and see what we can do, see if we can beat them. I'm going to watch them, and I'm going to lay down some scissor. Oh, it's on now, baby.
Right on, man. Well, tell me what you found out about these scientists that say they figured out how the Egyptians moved these stones, because I want to hear what your thoughts are, because I read the article, too.
Okay. Well, all right. Folks, you can go to CNET, the letter C, net.com. They have it on there. There's a bunch of it. It's only been up a few days. And basically, there's some physicists from the University of Amsterdam and the Foundation of Fundamental Research on Matter. And this is what they believe happened. They believe that if anybody's ever walked along the beach, you know when the sand is dry and loose, it's labor-intensive to walk along. You're burying up to your ankles and things like that in it. Well, what they believe they did was, or they believe this is what the Egyptians did because of a cartouche that was actually carved inside one of the tombs. that it shows like someone riding on front of a sled, pouring water in front of that sled, while many, many people are pulling the sled along by ropes. So what they believe is this. They believe that just like where the waves and the water, when it's real wet at the beach, right, how it's compact, that they would take these stones. They had a sled. They would put these stones on a sled.
Right, a giant sled.
Giant sled. They would water it and compact a certain percentage of water, you know, the certain mixture they had, right? They would pour and get this water or get the sand very damp, and it would be hard and slick, and then it would allow them to pull this sled along and slide the big stones up to the base and get ready to position them for the pyramid. Well, I saw what they were using. And look, now listen, folks, I know you're going to be shocked when I say this. I'm not a physicist. I know you probably you never believe me when I tell you this. I'm not a physicist. I'm not an engineer. I'm not any of anything. I'm nothing. Less than nothing. But look.
There's no arguments coming from over here.
That's right. What an ass. So we know, and you and I had this discussion just just last night.
Last night, yeah.
That if an ant falls off the Empire State Building, it doesn't kill the ant.
No.
Well, I saw the sled they were using to prove this, and it wasn't much bigger than a hardback book.
Hey, isn't that crazy?
And they had some weight stacked on it, and they had the sand on it. I'm like, look, okay, I get that. It doesn't give you the scaling that they used. It doesn't give you, and the reason I use the ant analogy is this. You can't prove to me that this is exactly how they move these stones without showing that they actually took a 2.5-ton stone on a sled without actually recreating it. Because if you use the ant off the Empire State Building, then yeah, the ant's not going to die. Does that mean it's safe for me to jump off? Because gravity doesn't work the same in smaller objects. I don't care how you scale it. You can get an idea. Yeah, it may do it, but I want to see what size sled, because now you're talking about enough people to move a 2.5-ton stone and a sled large enough and sturdy enough to hold a 2.5-ton stone.
I still don't buy it either, even if it was exactly the same. I just don't see how, first of all, you're talking about the Sahara Desert,
mm-hmm.
and they're talking about putting enough water in the sand to get the right mixture mm-hmm. so that this stuff would glide on there. How much freaking water are they going to have to put out? You know what I'm saying? Because mm-hmm. it's not like it's in a sand box where you can fill it with the garden hose, and eventually it's going to be more water than sand than it's going to be. You're talking about an infinite amount of sand. So you could be pouring millions of gallons on the sand, and it was just going to absorb it.
Yeah.
How are they going to – I mean, it just to me, the article does not prove to me that that's the way they did it. Now, and another thing is it's like, this is it. We solved it. It's definitive. That's it. I'm like, come on, man. That's an interesting theory, and I'm not saying it's wrong, but I wouldn't say that it's absolutely solved.
And that's the way they're treating it.
Absolutely.
It's definitive.
The way the article reads.
It reads as, this is it.
Case
we
closed.
Found out. Case closed. Well, I just wanted to, I threw some things together to give you an idea, and the people that are listening, most everybody knows what the Great Pyramid looks like, the size is. I just wanted to talk about it right quick to give you an idea of what they're working with.
Yeah. So lay it on us.
The original height of the Great Pyramid was 146.5 meters tall, or 480 feet.
All right? Okay.
That was now over erosion and settling and all that stuff. At present, it's only 138 meters, or 455 feet is the height that it is right now. The base is 230 meters long per side.
Right.
So that's 755 feet. The whole thing, they estimate, weighs a total of 5.9 million tons.
Whoa.
Where this is just the Great Pyramid.
Right.
They also estimate that it's somewhere between 2.3 and 2.5 million blocks that it took to build that pyramid. Now, there is some other conjecture to this that they believe that there's another man believes it's not even 600,000 stones that took it, but he has a different way of computing it and all that, and he's got a book on it and all this. The average weight of every stone that's in that Great Pyramid is 2.5 tons. That's the average weight. Now, they know that in the King's Chamber, they were a little bit larger. Like, they believe that they're between 40 and 50-ton stones in the King's Chamber. But so you're talking a 2.5-ton stone. Now,
everybody knows if you just get a sled and pour water on the sand, you can just slide right in there.
It's never been the fact of – you and I have had this discussion. I can't even count how many times we've kicked these numbers back and forth and talking. And it's one of those things. Folks, if you go off 2.5 million stones that's in there, and given the time frame that academia wants you to believe that it took 20 years to build it, to cut and place these 2.5 million stones, roughly it would be a stone every minute that was delivered and placed. So this is what it would have to be. Is in every minute, this is a 10-hour workday, you would have to place 34 to 43 stones an hour.
Or 33 to 34 stones an hour for 10 hours.
34 to 43 stones an hour for 10 hours. If you worked an 8-hour day, you have to place 42 to 53 stones an hour. Now, if you worked 365 days a year, that's 342 stones a day.
Right.
If you worked 290 days a year, like we do with weekends off, things like that, that's 431 stones a day. So that's a rough estimate, basically, of 500 stones a day for an 8-hour workday for 290 days a year for 20 years.
It'd take 20 years to do it.
That's 500 stones a day. Now, that's cut from the quarry, delivered and placed perfectly with no mistakes, 500 stones a day.
Yeah, there's no way.
It doesn't make sense. And I'm not saying, now listen, before we start getting tons of emails and people going nuts and you know, sending messages and tweets and everything like that, this is what I'm saying. I'm not saying it's aliens. I'm not saying ancient aliens built it.
No, I don't think it was.
I'm not getting into any of that. What I'm saying is the 20-year time frame that they tried to give us, I've heard of some academia, they've pushed it back to 30 years. If you give that time frame, it's still impossible. It's not something that you could readily do. And it's something that you've got to look at the force of people as far as the logistics that it would take for a workforce of this size working in the quarry to cut at the distance of the quarry was from the pyramid to bring the stones, move the stones, place the stones around the quarry and build it. And then they also know, around the pyramid, and then also stack them and move them. And then they also know that they had to be cut in different shapes as they get. So you would have to pre-plan.
I mean, they're perfect. They're precise.
You would have to know what level they were cutting so you could order those stones to be cut in the quarry.
Exactly.
You realize there's no downtime. That means everybody has to work like a finely tuned machine for 20 years nonstop. A finely tuned, no mistake machine. There are people today. You can't work that way. People, everybody listening, you work with folks in your office right now that you wouldn't even trust changing the paper out in a copying machine because it would cause more jam than good. I mean, we all know people. I mean, there's as bad as it is to say, there's people that just don't quite get it.
Especially when it's slave labor.
Well, exactly. So, like I said, I'm thinking this. I do know that there are other books I have read and other things I have read where the Egyptians said that those pyramids and those things were there when they got there.
Yes, I believe that.
So that's what I believe.
Earlier civilization created them. The Egyptians found them. They thought they were awesome and moved in.
Yeah, it was just they were there.
Well, they know that the face on the Sphinx is not the original face.
Yeah. I just have that feeling like, look, these things are much, much older than what we're given credit for, and maybe, and I'm not saying that if I was a pharaoh at the time, I wouldn't want to try to take a little credit for building something like that, you know what I mean? Who knows? And that's the thing. I don't believe that, and I don't believe that this is a good idea in theory, but I'd need to see it proved
where they
actually are using a sled and a block that big and really move it. Because if it works like a champ, I'll be the first one to go, look, I was wrong. I did not think it would work that way.
Yeah,
I didn't know, but like I said, I'm no engineer. I'm no physicist. I know it's a shock. I'm just a dummy. So that's it for the whole thing. So, well, I guess we need to jump into it with Mr. John Anthony West.
Let's do it, man. Stick with us, folks. After the break, we're going to get into the interview with John Anthony West. And it's really exciting, and we're really excited to have him on. So stay with us. This is Expanded Perspectives.
All right, folks. We have got a hell of a treat. This fellow that we are fixing to speak with right now is the one that really kind of got the ball rolling for me and Kyle years and years ago and blew our hair back with some of the amazing information that he brought forth. And it is a true honor to get to speak to this fellow. This is Mr. John Anthony West. Mr. West, how are you doing today?
I'm doing very well. Thank you, Kyle and Ken.
It's great. I mean, it really
is
great. It is. We've kept up with your work, like we've said off air. Whenever we were young men, we first saw the documentary with Charlton Heston, and you were talking about the water erosion on the Sphinx. And back then, it was really a new idea. It was something really that nobody could wrap their heads around. And it seems like now there are dozens of little things that add vindication to all of your theories that what you and Dr. Schott came up with.
Yes, actually, some of them are not little things either. Some of them are major things. And it's interesting obviously you've been following it from the very beginning. So in the beginning, and I should say actually right from the get-go, that the water weathering to the Sphinx was not my idea. It was, or not my original idea. It came from the genius with the unpronounceable name, R.A. Schwaller-De Lubitsch, who put together in a number of, I mean, I regard Schwaller as probably the most important scholar, not just of the 20th century, but maybe of all time, who put together and reformulated the ancient sacred science in a way that made it accessible to our modern over-rationalized intellects. And in one of his books, his masterwork is called Le Temple de l'Homme, The Temple of Man, which when I did my book on him, had not been translated from French, but now it is in a wonderful translation, great book. But it's like taking your first driving lesson in a Ferrari if you're not used to this sort of thing. Anyway, it was Schwaller who was looking into the Egyptian, the ancient Egyptian belief, or belief, maybe they knew that, anyway, their records talk about long periods of civilization pre-dynastic Egypt. Dynastic Egypt, that's the Egypt we're all familiar with, starts around 3500 BC. And in these several documents, one is a stone tablet, the other one is a fragmentary a papyrus, the stone tablet called the Palermo stone because it's in Palermo in Italy, second called the Turin papyrus, not because it's about Turin, but because it's in the Turin Museum, where they detail explicitly, they talk about long reigns when Egypt was ruled first by what they call the by the Netcheru, which means the gods themselves, and secondly, when it's, again, a long period when they're ruled by the Shemsuhor, which means the companions or the followers of Horus. And they give the names of these rulers and their regnal years. And when you compute all of those out, you actually get something around. They're a little bit, they're both fragmentary, the stone, the tablet and the papyrus, but they're talking about something like 36,000 years. Anyway, de Lubitsch, in one of his ancillary books called The King of the Pharaonic Theocracy, all of this de Lubitsch stuff, actually, which was not translated when I was doing this work back in the early 70s, is now all translated and very well, too, so anybody can read it. Anyway, he's talking about the Egyptian belief that their own civilization went back much, much further. And at a certain point, he brings together the scholarly arguments and the quotes from the Latin and Greek writers who were working in Egypt around that time. And then, almost as an afterthought, throws out this line. And of course, the Great Sphinx of Giza shows unmistakable signs of aquatic erosion, water weathering. And when I read that, I was doing my own research for my first book on Egypt called Serpent in the Sky, The High Wisdom of Ancient Egypt, which is an in-depth introduction to Schwaller. As I said, raw, unadulterated Schwaller is not for everyone. It's very difficult stuff. But I sort of provide a bridge to his magisterial work. Anyhow, when I read that line, I said, oh, well, that's all the rest of it is a scholarly argument. But water weathering is water weathering. And that, in theory, is science. If you can prove it, and I got this in an instant. It was one of those revelations that if you could prove that the Great Sphinx of Giza had been water weathered, it would basically destroy everything that anyone has ever been taught in school about ancient history, or very ancient history, because it would mean that, and mind you, at this time when I came across this, I'd already put several years of research into Serpent in the Sky, but I realized that if you could prove that, the Sphinx is arguably or almost incontestably the most spectacular sculpture on Earth, even though it's in ruinous condition. And the temples that surround it they're not that huge as Egyptian temples go, but they're constructed of stones that weigh, you know, upwards of 100 tons each, slotted into place like pieces of a jigsaw puzzle or like giant building blocks. And, of course, the flower of our present civilization, which I call is not really a civilization, it's progress is the antithesis of civilization. I call it the Church of Progress. Its central dogma is that we're the most advanced beings that have ever existed on the face of the planet. We who create the hydrogen bomb, and nerve gas and Disneyland and striped toothpaste. We're the best there ever was. And the people who created the Temple of Luxor and the pyramids and all of these other things in Egypt and the cathedrals of Chartres, all of these were primitive, superstitious people. Anyhow, the point is that technology and science are the pride of the civilization. And if you could prove that the Sphinx dated many, many thousands of years older even than dynastic Egypt, and the Sphinx is, as I said, is not too many people would argue that this is the most spectacular sculpture on Earth. And when you do a bit of research into the temples that surround it, you find that modern project engineers, the guys who work with the cranes that can lift 1,000 tons and things like that, when they see the problems involved in building one of these temples of 100-ton blocks and things of that sort that are slotted into place, as I said, like pieces of a jigsaw puzzle, they say, well, we couldn't do that with our machinery. So if you could prove that the Sphinx is weathered by water, it would mean that a civilization capable of producing one of the greatest or the greatest sculpture of all time, and these temples that we couldn't reproduce today with our advanced technology, existed at a time when there's not supposed to be any civilization at all. Everything has to be rethought. Right from the get-go, everything has to be rethought. So you can see why we've encountered the opposition that we have. This is no surprising. You have to realize that academics, or who I like to call quackademics, there's no glamour to being a quackademic, not much anyway, and there's not much money either. These guys have their PhDs that they work very hard for, and their egos, you might say their souls insofar as they have them, their egos are completely bound up in their status as experts. And then along suddenly comes a guy like me from out of left field with no credentials whatsoever and says, well, here's the scientific proof, scholarly proof, that you're completely wrong. And everything you've been talking about for all of these years is baloney. Well, they're not going to like you very much.
No.
I can appreciate that.
Yeah, you weren't making friends very fast like that.
No, but that's okay. I enjoy that, actually. I mean, most of my colleagues, many of them, would... Well, see, I didn't start out as a scholar. I started out as a novelist, playwright, scriptwriter. And, I mean, I knew just a little bit of autobiography, a couple of lines, that at the age of 13, I knew that I'd been born into a lunatic asylum. I knew that it was crazy and that everybody was lying, including myself. And by the time I was 19, I knew what I wanted to do, which was to be a writer. And I wanted to be the little boy who said the emperor has no clothes. And that's what I started off doing. And one thing led to another. It's a complicated, kind of interesting, long story. But when I finally got into Egypt, I realized that there was an alternative and that the Church of Progress really was a catastrophe. I mean, I sometimes describe it as the Western civilization as the worst catastrophe that hit the human race since monogamy. This is an absolutely pernicious philosophy, and it is false. It is not science. It is not science-based. So suddenly, when I got into Egypt, I realized it was a chance to really upset a lot of people, to really make waves. And so, basically, that's what I've been doing. But to get back to the point you were making, when we did that, really, that was groundbreaking, because there was other evidence out there, but nothing with the kind of backup that you could provide for the Sphinx. Once I got Shock on board, that's another long story. But when finally Shock got on board, and Shock's a very cautious guy, when he finally realized that the evidence was incontrovertible, he stuck his tenured neck on, put it on the block, supported it. That led to the GSA, the Geological Society of America's annual meeting, which is kind of the Super Bowl of geology, back in 91, and then that, through a series of very strange circumstances. The whole story, Shock and I are going to write a book very shortly. We're going to be working on a book about the whole Sphinx story. And now that we've got the smoking gun with Göbekli Tepe and maybe Gunung Padang, there's a whole bunch of stuff out there. But anyhow, so we'll be doing a book about it. But at that time, all we had, all we really needed to have in theory, if scientists were actually open-minded, which they're not. I mean, when I give lectures, I often come out with a line which always gets a laugh, that finding an open-minded scientist is like finding a fundamentalist Christian who loves his enemies. Few and far between. So anyway, when, you know, the fact that the evidence was the evidence and that the geologists were almost 100% in agreement made waves, but they kept on saying, you've seen the video, probably saw the whole thing with the AAAS, American Association for the Advancement of Science, supposed debate with Mark Lehner saying, mm-hmm. show me a pot chart. Well, I used to joke and say, you know, well, it was a really advanced civilization. They didn't have pot charts. They had paper cups. But, of course,
it was all biodegradable. They took care of the planet.
That's absolutely biodegradable. But anyway, so now we still don't have any pot charts, but we have a whole gigantic, elegantly constructed civilization going with Göbekli Tepe, which is a mind blower. And, I mean, even the quackademics are not arguing about the dating. They're accepting it, but they're not doing it exactly. Because this was, Göbekli Tepe was the lead, it was the cover of National Geographic, May 2012, I think, 2012 or 2011. Anyway, I know it was a May issue. And so they go into it in considerable detail, but what they don't say, they kind of avoid saying, hey, this is a game changer. This turns the whole thing around. No longer can you talk about primitive hunter-gatherers, you know, before they invent or before they develop agriculture, 7,000-8,000 BC, thereabouts, before the great civilizations of Mesopotamia and Egypt and China and India and probably Mesoamerica as well, arise 3,500, 3,000 BC, it was all just, you know, hunter-gatherers doing simple things and whittling, you know, carving out arrowheads and that sort of stuff. Suddenly you have Göbekli Tepe, this unbelievable place of, I mean, the whole story is very complicated and I won't get into it here, but 22 closely adjacent mini Stonehenges, and not that many, I mean, blocks of stone weighing 10, 15 tons each and intricately carved in high relief, which is the most difficult kind of carving to do, because it means that, let's say you want to carve an animal. So you draw the animal on the surface of the stone, and then you cut the stone away so that the animal or the bird or the bee or whatever it happens to be looks as though it's emerging out of the stone rather than being cut into the stone. They're doing this at a time when apparently they don't have any tools. I mean, really, this is spectacular because it's assumed that they did this somehow or another with flint tools. And, I mean, there is no, you know, you don't have a Dremel tool to work with.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I mean, it just reconfirms your original thoughts.
See, and so when you really look at Göbekli Tepe, this is unbelievable. I mean, this is spectacular. And that's us. I mean, that's one of our smoking guns. So now, having fought this battle for all of these years, and this is what our book is going to be about, is the whole battle, because, I mean, we've been a flak coming at us, and the abuse and all of this kind of stuff. And, I mean, Schock, you know, Schock is not a satirist by trade. So initially, you know, he didn't really know how to react to all of this abuse. I expected it. And to me, when these guys attack, I mean, I feel the way a cannibal chieftain must feel watching a boatload of missionaries approach.
Right.
I couldn't be happier, particularly now when you've got the internet. Before, it used to be irritating because they'd attack publicly and there was no way for me to attack back publicly because they wouldn't print it.
Yeah, and for our listeners that may not know, in the early 90s, there was a movie that came out called Mysteries of the Sphinx, and that's what John's referring to. Is he was one of the first guys to discover that, and I wasn't aware. When I first saw it, I didn't know that the age of the Sphinx was even contested until I saw that movie, and I became very interested in and I always thought it was just known. You know, when they teach you in school, you're like, okay, it was made 2500 BC. It was made after Kephren. It's his face. And then it turns out, you know, after I saw your show, I started looking into it. And that's not exactly so. There's people that don't even think it's Kephren's face, that they think that it could be a different race's face on there, maybe a lion's head originally. And based on some of the stuff I've read, the way the structures are set out, that by the precession of the equinoxes, that it's far older than what I was taught.
Well, and they're even history in the Egyptian history themselves. They say themselves that they're a much older culture, yet the Egyptologists today don't even want to read their own that history.
No, no, they know more about Egyptian history than the ancient Egyptians.
Yeah, makes no sense.
And so the battle you guys are referring to is when you first brought this data out, you know, it was highly contested, but now these other structures that are being found, you're being vindicated, you know, almost, you know.
Well, we are, but it's still highly contested because it's still their battlefield. In other words, it's we're fighting it out on their battlefield. So what happens when you're fighting on their arena, when they don't like the evidence, they change the rules. And when they can't do that because you still overthrow the rules, then they move the goalposts.
It's like playing cards with a child.
You know, or they try to discredit you because you don't have a degree or certain
letters
piece of paper
after your name.
Right,
that's,
you know.
No. Well, they can do that with me.
But it's ridiculous. That's not science.
Jacques. Yeah, they can't with Robert.
They can't with Jacques. No, actually, that's a funny story about that. When this thing first came out, it was when 93, the, no, it was the 91, the GSA meeting. And Jacques came out in favor. And it was a big deal, this. I mean, it made the science press all over the world. It was a big story. And lots, you know, press was there, and we were doing interviews all over the place, Jacques and myself. And Jacques teaches at Boston University. And we had a telephone interview with a guy who was the science editor of the Boston Globe, which is the big paper there. And so Jacques was being his usual civil self in the interview. And then the guy interviewed me and he said, well, you know, what is this? You're the geologist and, you know, you have these people, you know, really going after us big time. I mean, insulting us, character assassination, all this kind of stuff. And he said, what's behind that? And I said, look, you know, this is a question of water weathering patterns or weathering patterns on rocks. And when it comes to weathering patterns on rocks, an Egyptologist and the opinion of an Egyptologist or an archaeologist is no more valid than the opinion of a proctologist.
You're 100% right, though. I mean,
and he published that. So,
that is great.
So then...
You're a real smartass, aren't you, John?
John puts it to him, don't he?
I like it.
I am a satirist.
He's honest.
I'm a novelist by trade. I'm a scholar by default. So what I bring to this whole thing is, I mean, you know, I do a comedy act. I can be funny about stuff that people are not usually funny about. So I'm really dangerous.
Yeah, but you're 100% right. I mean. Yeah. Just because they're an Egyptologist doesn't mean they have anything about geology.
They don't know anything about rocks.
So anyway, this woman whose name I will not mention because she'll probably sue me, at Boston University, archaeologist, I think, or Egyptologist, or both, wrote a really nasty character assassination of shock on the in-house Boston University journal or newspaper, whatever the devil it's called. And I said to Shock, you know, Shock, you can't. Let them get away with this. You've got to respond. Chuck said, no, just let it go. I'll handle it my way. And I said, well, do you mind if I write her personally?
Uh-oh.
He said, no, go ahead. That's okay. So I wrote her a long letter. And I said, I started out by saying, listen, I understand that you and your department take this line of mine about the, you know, proctologists and the Egyptologists. You know, that got you very upset. And I said, well, you should know that it got the proctologists upset, too. Because they said their job was to cure sick assholes. So what she did, it was like Brer Rabbit and the Briar Patch. She went and she sent this out to the whole Egyptological community. I mean, I couldn't have done that myself.
Yeah, worked perfect.
We could have done. But anyway, so this thing has been going on now. That's 20 years. You know, that's 93 that the documentary came out.
Yeah.
Don't remind me, John. My knee feels it every morning when I get up.
Well, yours feels it. How old are you?
38.
Oh, God. More than double your age.
It's not the years. It's the mileage.
Well, the mileage. Anyway, so we're now, Chuck and I are going to write the book. We're setting up a foundation. I had a foundation for myself, but I kept the book so badly that the lawyer said, oh, forget it, just start a new one. So we're doing that to try and get both money together to carry on with the research, which is a big deal, and then more money together to do a follow-up video of Mystery of the Sphinx. So this is the position that we're now in. We, between Göbekli Tepe and now Gunung Padang, Chuck has just been there. And Chuck is a really cautious guy. You know, I mean, he couldn't have a better colleague than Chuck because he really is smart. He really knows his science. And he's got the credentials, and he's very, very, very cautious. I mean, super cautious, so that he really only... I mean, he has to be 100% convinced that the evidence is the evidence and cannot be overthrown. So, I mean, this is more part of the fun of the book when we get around to writing it, because getting Chuck to make a declarative sentence in the beginning was nightmarish. I mean, everything was conditional on this and that and the other. And then now, funnily enough, I mean, he's more out there than I am in certain ways. His last book was about the evidence for ESP and things like that. I mean, he's really opened up, Chuck. But as a scientist, he's as cautious as ever he was. So now we really have the evidence to hand. And if we can put the money to do this video, the follow-up to Mystery of the Sphinx, this could be a big deal. And I mean, this is not, you understand this, I think. I'm sure you do, just from a little bit of conversation we had. This is not a quibble among academics. I mean, it really doesn't matter how old is the Sphinx. Why should it matter? What matters is that we're under the control now, scientifically, economically, financially, all sorts of ways, educationally. We're in the grip of what I call the Church of Progress, that we're the most advanced beings that ever existed. And we're watching this thing crumble in front of our eyes. We're watching the cocksucker brothers commandeering the whole goddamn stage. I mean, the worst people in the world are in charge of the country. And I mean, both sides are as bad as each other. They're just different degrees of badness. And unless somebody restores a sense of a true sense of the sacred, I mean, the problem with the religions is that the people who keep talking the most about the religions are the ones who know least about them and don't practice them at all. If they did, we wouldn't be in the pickle that we're in. And of course, the anti-religious group, the so-called rationalists and materialists and Church of Progress faithful, they're by definition malevolent because they destroy the sense of the meaning of our own individual and collective lives. I mean, if you think if you're really convinced, because this is what we're taught in school, that our lives are worthless, the chances are that you're not going to be living your life in a very productive or creative fashion.
That's right.
So,
not to catch up, but speaking of corrupt people in charge, wasn't Zahi Hawass in charge when you were first starting all this?
Yeah, but that's another funny long story.
Because like, didn't it come out that he was selling things on the black market?
No, he wasn't doing that. But he was, for a variety of reasons, virulently opposed to us. And we had this big fight going on, you know, not physically, but
right,
with him insulting us and me writing, saying nasty things about him. And then, it's a really weird story. I mean, this will be a piece of this book, which will be a pretty extensive book. But I was doing trips with a guy. I mean, I knew better, but he was, organization is not my strength. And he was organizing trips for me. And he was just, it was like dealing with, you know, in a former lifetime, this guy had been a used chariot salesman or something. And I finally broke with him, and he retaliated by, he put more, I said, this is the last trip we're going to do. And he loaded the trip up with more people than I could handle. And that's like, you know, if you have a bucket and you fill it to the brim, well, it's full to the brim. It's heavy to carry. But if you keep pouring stuff into it, it's going to go over the brim and the whole thing is going to be unmanageable. So he did this with a trip. And so I split with him, and I was very nasty to him. And he retaliated by, because what I do on my trips, and I should say this, you know, anybody's interested in Egypt, Egypt is a game changer. It teaches you what a real civilization is like. Nowhere else in the world can you experience anything remotely like Egypt. Usually I start off electric. And I say, get people interested. They think they're going to hear all this scholarship, which they are. But I tell them, Egypt is like sex. And they say, well, why is it like sex? And I say, well, you know, you can read all about it, and that's interesting. You look at pictures, that's maybe even more interesting. But until you've actually experienced it, you do not understand anything about it.
I believe that.
And this is true. So anyway, Egypt is a game changer. So back to Zahi. So, so this guy wrote, what I do is technically illegal. I'm not supposed to lecture on the site, but as long as I have an Egyptian guide with me, and that's a good rule, in fact, because otherwise everybody's been to Egypt four times and say, why should we pay an Egyptian guide who's gone through 4 or 5 years of school and passed the test, which is not easy to pass? Why should I spend the money on the guide when I can do all of this myself? Which in fact they can't do. It's not that easy to do. For me, really, I don't need somebody there. I teach the guides, but that's good. I like having the guides with me because they run interference when it comes to shopping and all of that kind of stuff. Anyhow, so this guy wrote a letter to the Minister of Tourism saying that I was lecturing on site. And that letter ended up on Zahi Hawass's desk. And so he called up the guy who runs our tour operator, who runs my tour for me, a good personal friend and also a good personal friend of Zahi. This is about more than 10 years ago, must be 98, something like that. And he said to Muhammad Nasri, my friend, he said, look, he said, this letter has come on my desk. And, you know, John and I are not friends. And, you know, I know that he makes a living out of doing this. I'm not going to act upon this. So Muhammad called me up, no Skype in those days, and said, hey, look, Zahi is doing this for you, and when you're in Egypt next, which is going to be a couple of weeks, I think you should thank him. I said, you bet I should. So I got there, and I went to Zahi's office, and Zahi's office was always chaos, 5 6 phones at once, and people on their knees begging for permission to do this, that, and the other. So he finally gets to me, And I tell him, you know, Zahi, Muhammad told me what you did, and I really want to thank you for doing that. It's, you didn't have to do that, and I'd really like this war to be over. And he said, yes, John, but you started it. I didn't say I didn't start it. He started it. But anyhow, I didn't say that. But since then, we've developed a kind of a weird friendship, because in public, he's as opposed to Shaq and myself as he ever was. But privately, we get on quite well. Huh. And actually, I've always had this sense, and now that he's out of office, technically, he could be coming back in, but he doesn't even want to. He's a big shot now. He can call his own shots. So he can actually do more, both for himself and even, you know, for Egyptology, being not the head of the whole gig. And I'm hoping, he promised he would do this. And then when all the stuff, the protests and things were going on, he said that the people are out gunning for him there. You know, he's made a lot of enemies. And he thought that this, the I wanted to get him to the Giza Plateau to personally show him the evidence and have him quiet so that he's not on six phones at once and saying, look, Zaki, this is the case. A, B, C, D, blah, 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 blah.
John, are you going to convert Zahi Hawass?
I've always felt that I might. That he might be open, and if he were not exactly convertible, at least he would say, listen, this is serious, and we have to do more study. I wouldn't expect them to say, well, I guess I was wrong.
If you convert Zahi Hawass, that's almost bigger than finding water erosion on the Sphinx itself.
No. I get the sense from things that he says, from actually the personal level that we have, where we have a dinner, and you know, he comes, I have a group, and he comes and makes a lot of noise and talks to people and all the rest. And I know the Egyptians are, anyhow, very, like the Arabs in general, are very emotional people. They don't sort of repress everything the way we Westerners do. And if they like you, they're not faking it. It's there. And if they don't like you, you know it in 2 seconds. So I get the sense that, and I've had it for a long time, that if Zahi saw the evidence, if he had his, you know, if he had it really shown, okay, Zahi, look, here's this. You know, if you want to oppose the theory, you have to be able to address these different pieces of evidence. And there's a lot of it. It's pointless to talk about them on radio because they're really very visual.
There was something I wanted to ask you, and it goes into all of Egypt, and you've been over there hundreds of times, is why is it, and I think it explains perfectly to your theory and what's holding true, is it does seem like the older architecture is actually better made,
yep,
and more amazing in itself, really, than the newer. It's like when you see a civilization.
Yeah, it's like the craftsmanship is better.
It starts off bad and gets better. Not there. It starts off really good and then looks like it's just been maintained or been patched or been handymanned together the whole time.
By and large, but that gets us into another kind of complexity. That gets us into the what the Indians, the Hindus, in the Vedas called, you know, the Kali Yuga, the cycles of, which is also Platonic, Golden Age, Silver Age, Bronze Age, Iron Age, or Dark Age, and then the cycle starts going up again. Now, this is another complicated issue, but that's, I think, what we're looking at. That, and then in between all of this comes whatever the catastrophe was back around 12,000 BC, and then another one around 9600 BC, Chaka's convinced that one of them, what is it, the Younger Dryas, that's the one 12,000 BC,
mm-hmm,
is a cometary event of some sort, and the later one is a coronal blast from...
Yeah, mass coronal ejection.
Mass coronal ejection, and that's what brings on the flood and the melting of the Ice Age and all of that stuff. I may have it not quite right, but Chaka is very knowledgeable about that. If you get him on in a couple of weeks, you can get into that with him.
And we've got his books. Yeah,
his newest book is Forgotten Civilization or something, and I think that's exactly what it's about.
He knows the stuff, and we have different... I mean, I'm much more, let's say, familiar with... I'm not a scientist, but I'm much more familiar with the esoteric aspects of it and philosophy and the religion and the symbolism and, to a certain extent, the geometry and all that sort of stuff. So it's a good combination, actually, because we have complementary strengths rather than the same strengths. If it's the same strength, why do you need a collaborator?
That's right.
Have different ones, that's good.
What we were discussing earlier with the precession of the equinox, could you tell the listeners about the way the layout of the pyramids and the way the layout of the Sphinx facing Leo, it almost lines up astronomically to a certain actual number of years in the past also?
Well, yeah. Actually, the precession of the equinoxes, for example, if you look now at the the zodiac, and the reasons why this happens are in dispute. But if you look at the spring equinox now, before the sun rises, and watch where the sun comes up, you'll find that it comes up in the last degrees, the very last degrees of, and this is arguable because it's not as though there's a line in the sky, but the last degrees of Pisces, meaning that it's precession, so it goes around backwards, so that the next age will be the age of Aquarius. And this is, you know, hair and all of those things, the age of Aquarius. So when you look at the Sphinx faces due east, and it's a lion now with a man's head. It might not have had a man's head to begin with. It might have been a lion. It's been recarved. All of these things are, I mean, this is tough to do on radio because, it's hard to get the visual images for it. And all of these things are very complex. So anyway, the last time, if the Sphinx, it kind of screams out as an astronomical, astrological marker of Leo, because it's a lion. And if the Sphinx is facing due east, the last time that the spring equinox occurred in the age of Leo was 10,000 years ago. Well, sorry, around 10,000 BC. And the time before that, because it's a 26,000 year cycle, is 36,000 BC. Now, what's interesting about that is that 36,000 BC cycle corresponds to what the Egyptians are talking about themselves in the Palermo Stone and the Turin Papyrus. Schock was initially very cautious about this earlier dating, even though the Egyptian texts themselves are talking about, when you compute all those regnal years for all of those divine kings and semi-divine kings, which of course the quackademics simply ignore, don't regard as real, or just as primitive imagination. You compute those out, and you get something like that's 36,000 years. They disagree with each other a little bit, 34,000 years, 36,000 years, but roughly speaking, that's the kind of date that they're putting on this. And this is not so fantastic. I mean, when you're dealing with the quackademics, there are other pieces of evidence that suggest, I mean, apart, we got Göbekli Tepe, and now there's Gunung Padang, the Schock again, in this cautious way. He spent a week there, and he said, yeah, this really looks like it's very, very old, but lots more work has to be done there. With Göbekli Tepe, lots more work has to be done, but there it's really pretty solid. And Klaus Schmidt, the German archaeologist who's the head of the excavation, he's not a flake. He's an absolutely orthodox Egyptologist, or rather archaeologist with, a rare quality. He doesn't think he knows everything. That's rare in any of these sciences.
Yeah.
He's the one who put the dating on it, and this has got to be solid because even his own colleagues are not challenging him on it. So that's important. If we're saying it, or even Schock, with all his credentials, well, we're already committed to a different point of view. They could attack us, but they're not attacking Schmidt. This is serious. And we've got all of this evidence now. And even before that, if people put the evidence together or recognize its implications, the case would already be a strong one. For example, the Paleolithic caves. You know about those, right? Of course, Lascaux and Altamira.
Yes.
Right? And do you know about the most spectacular one found relatively recently called Chauvet?
Yes, I watched the documentary on that one.
But you watched that documentary, the Herzog thing. Unfortunately, Herzog's a wonderful director, and that was a lousy film where he just let the quackademics blather on without any sense of how important this really was. But they date that, and it's hard to imagine that the dating is incorrect, to 31,000 BC, and as art, it's of a much higher level than even Lascaux and the Hall of Bulls in Altamira, which are dated around 17 and 19,000 BC. So you've got these guys putting paint on rough walls, presumably with their fingers, in how could they light the damn things, you know, and painting animals that look like they've been painted by Picasso. So, you know, maybe they're living in grass in reed huts and they're wearing bear skins. But, but, you know, you can't take a whole bunch of PhD quantum physicists and stick them in a cave and tell them to paint bulls and you know, and lions and things like that with their bare hands and get anything out of them. So even things like that presupposes an extremely sophisticated artistic sensibility. And of course, you know, these jackasses think, you know, the artists and creative people are, you know, we're regarded as kind of nutcases and things like that. And the only thing that really means anything is rational science and proving this, that, and the other. And this is from people who can't, with their own bare hands, put a dry stone wall together, much less write a sonnet, compose a symphony. So the whole thing is completely topsy-turvy and upside down. And as I said, this concept, and it's not just me, it's Grant, it's lots of people now. I mean, it started off by Schwaller in terms of Egyptology and, you know, certain other people throughout. It's not as though we invented this from scratch. We're carrying on, but with better evidence, seams that have been going on, well, from time immemorial, but for sure, since Madame Blavatsky and Theosophy in the latter half of the 19th century. You know, we're not inventing this from scratch, but we're putting scientific and scholarly teeth into it that it didn't have before. So the only thing that's going to get us, as far as I'm concerned, the only thing that's going to get us out of the morass that we're dug into by our own stupidity and greed and all of these, you know, all of the terrible stuff that's going on is the changing of ideas. I mean, it's Victor Hugo, a famous line, you probably know it. There's one thing stronger than all the armies in the world, and that's an idea whose time has come. Well, this was good, but what he neglected to say or observe was that the second strongest thing in the world is an idea whose time has not yet gone. So we think we've got the idea whose time has come, but it's not going to come automatically. It's only going to come if we make the right moves and enough of us get behind it to make it happen. And meanwhile, the second strongest idea in the world is, you know, the whole all of quackademia, modern education, which I describe somewhere, where one of my books, as modern education is to the mind what AIDS is to the immune system. The more the more contact you have with it, the more likely it is to be lethal. And it's like that. I mean, mm-hmm. Go talk to a PhD at any party and see what kind of who you're talking to. There are exceptions, of course. Shock is one of them. But like HIV, you can carry HIV in your body your whole life and be perfectly healthy. But one thing goes wrong and you're cooked. Anyhow, so the crux of it is, as I said, the importance of this is, repeat myself, it's not a quibble among academics. It's a question of enough people recognizing that our lives have a meaning and that we're on this earth for a specific purpose. I mean, Egypt is a one-issue civilization, and that civilization was devoted to, at least at its higher levels, but even in the lower levels, the quarrymen and the people who were doing the building and all of it, it's trickle down, you might call it trickle down spirituality, which is valid. And it's devoted, it's consecrated to the idea that there is such a thing as the immortality of the soul. And all of Egypt, everything that was religious in one sense or another, and religion is what, in its true sense, not idiots telling women what to do with their body or, you know, whether gays should marry or not, as if it was any of their goddamn business. and actually, they should, you know, I mean, they don't think straight, these gay bashes and stuff, because when you really look at it, you look at most of these guys who are the most adamant about it, and you can see that these are guys who have a lot of trouble getting laid. And And if they really, really went out and promoted homosexuality, if there were enough guys who were gay, it's a joke, you know, the famous joke. You know, why is it that it's so difficult for a woman to find a, you know, a good looking, intelligent, sensitive, you know, financially sound male? And the answer is, well, they've already got boyfriends. And so if the gay bashers would sort of promote it, I mean, if there are enough guys really turn gay, they'd find some woman who'd even sleep with them, whereas otherwise it's difficult. So it's very counterproductive. It's very counterproductive on their part. I lost my thread. What were we on about here?
Well, I was going to ask you, John, do you feel like it's that more people with the freedom of information due to the internet, due to these podcasts, YouTube, due to all these blogs, do you feel like more people are beginning to take notice faster on the information that you're providing as far as all the... Seems like it's definitely snowballing faster the last few years.
Yeah. Listen, when I got into this, when I first booked The Case for Astrology, I mean, it was a book and, you know, it was not too unsuccessful, but, you know, it doesn't have an impact. But The Mystery of the Sphinx, I mean, that was sort of a miracle that we actually got that thing onto NBC and it went viral around.
And you got Charlton Heston, which you can't argue with Moses when he's standing up there on true, the Sphinx true. Telling you that shit.
That's right. Well,
can't argue with that.
Well, we did get Charlton Heston. Actually, that was a funny story. Originally, what we wanted was, let's see, when was this, 93? And so we wanted, first choice was Harrison Ford, because you needed an image. So
that would have been awesome.
So that was the Indiana Jones image, would have been perfect. But he liked the idea, but he was too busy, and we couldn't get him, and he was too expensive. So the next choices were Charlton Heston, Moses' image, and Raymond Burr, Perry Mason's solver of puzzles image. And Heston, I didn't like much like his politics. And, you know, he's sort of a wooden actor and Moses image and Ben-Hur and all this stuff. So I was sort of for Raymond Burr. But we would ask around, and we could afford both of them. It was the same $75,000 for the day. You know, that was low. Harrison Ford would have been about four times that. Anyway, So I was sort of a Raymond Burr, but we were asking all of us involved in the thing. And we talked to our friends, and the women would say, this was the choice, Raymond Burr and Charlton Heston. The women would all say, wow, Charlton Heston. And we said, okay, we don't care. Us guys don't care really if it's Charlton Heston or Raymond Burr. But if the women who are half the audience think that Charlton Heston is cool, good, we'll go with Charlton. And then he turned in this wonderful performance. I mean, he really liked the script. Strangely enough, the really ultra-white right-wing guys have less trouble with our stuff. Now, he wasn't ultra-right-wing, but the sort of the right-wingers have much less trouble with the whole concept of an advanced ancient civilization than the left-wingers who, whatever they may say, are priests of the Church of Progress. They really do believe... Well, they believe in selection pressure and Darwinian evolution, which is evolution is a fact. Selection pressure and Darwinian evolution is a fraud, but that's another matter to go into at some future date. Jock and I are going to do another, we hope, the definitive book on anti-Darwin book.
And the way it's going, we're going to have you on another half a dozen times, John.
Well, okay. Let's see if we get it's fun. But I've got to tell you, you know, it's fun for me too, as long as I've got my vodka and here we are, Gavin.
That's right.
But something has to come out of it. Because, you know, in other words, people going on my trips or, you know, there needs to be some feedback. So let's see what happens.
And I also like that you talk about not just the Sphinx, but there's a lot of other structures there in Egypt where it almost looks like they were built upon an even older structure that's beneath
tons
that.
Of them.
Yeah, so that almost lends, you know, credence to that there's an older civilization, much older than the mainstream archaeologists agree.
If on this next trip, which is just a few days from now, if I get Zahi to come around with me, and he's promised to do so, and in fact, a while back, but then there was all of this trouble going on. And as I said, I didn't finish that thought earlier, because there are a lot of people gunning for Zahi around the plateau, because he threw people out of their houses because he wanted to dig under them to look for artifacts and things like that. Well, that didn't make him any friends.
Right.
So when the infrastructure broke down, he said, yeah, he'd go with me. And then he decided, no, this is, too many people gunning for him, and he didn't trust the security. But now the security should be okay again, and we'll see if he comes along with me, because that's exactly what I want to show him, that there are all of these different pieces of evidence, each one of them in and of itself commanding, compelling. If just one of them is correct, like the water weathering to the Sphinx, there's no arguing with all the rest, but there are lots of them. There are dozens of things to show him that support the theory, and nothing that challenges it. So we'll see. Call me back somewhere. I get back. When do I get back? 15th of February, sometime the end of February. Call me back, and I'll give you a status report.
Okay.
Where we stand with that.
That sounds good.
And in the meanwhile, where are we now? Oh, we're at an hour mark. Let's because this, as you see, the way I've been babbling on here in Egypt, this is 8 hours a day of this, and I'm still racing for time because it's such a big subject. But I think for your purposes, you've got a pretty good idea, even though it's sort of jumbled and garbled. People should have a pretty good idea of what's involved, and let's see what kind of feedback you get, and I'm game for more. I enjoy doing this. It's fun. It's fun getting it out to people. But again, I don't like to sound crass about it, but what's in it for me? If nobody gets back to you, and it's fun and game for you guys, but it would be some people sign on for trips or ask intelligent questions or buy some books or something like that.
Right. Well, how often do you do these trips?
I have been doing them about four times a year, and they've been cut way back recently because of the revolution and all this stuff. I have this one coming up, which is full, next week. And then I'm hoping, and I don't even have it up on my website yet because I'm hopelessly inefficient about that stuff, but there may be one March 12th to March 25th. And whether or not that works, I don't know. But anybody listening wants to jump onto that one, good, it's open. And then,
how do people, if they're interested in going on a tour with you instructing it? Where do people go to sign up for something like that?
To my website.
And what is that?
JAWest.com.
Okay.
And you click on Magical Egypt Tours, and as I said, the March trip. The full details aren't there, but the last trip, the details are there, and it's close enough to that so you can judge. Or they email me. Well, that information is on the website, but it's my initials, JAW, Sphinx, SPHINX, at AOL.com. So get in touch. And then there'll certainly be a trip, as long as Egypt doesn't disintegrate, and I don't think it will now that the military's in charge. There'll be a trip end of October, early November, and then another one late November or December. So plenty of opportunity. And as I mentioned earlier, the sooner the better, because as soon as, Egypt, you just can't imagine what it's like empty.
It's a perfect time to do it. If I had the money, I would do it. And if I was there, I would most certainly want you to guide me.
You're in Texas. I thought everybody was rich in Texas.
Well, not all of us.
Anyway, the sooner you get onto it, because, having done as many trips as I've done, I've learned where people are going to be at what sort of time. So we're very good at avoiding the worst of the crowds, no matter what. But avoiding not having crowds there at all is just, it's heaven. It's like, you know, nobody's experienced Egypt like that since the 1850s. It's really, you just can imagine what it's poor. I mean, it's horrible for the poor Egyptians because so many of them depend upon the tourist trade for their living.
Yeah, but, I could imagine.
Well, it's really, it's heart wrenching. But I mean, it's not our fault that the other, you know, that people aren't going there. So for us, it's take advantage of this wonderful situation.
Well, anyway. That's incredible. And I wished I had the money to go and join you. And maybe one day soon I will. I just want to thank you again for coming on. Your work is fascinating. It was eye-opening to me. You're one of the first people that ever made me start to question that what I was taught in school about ancient cultures and Egypt especially is not necessarily true. And
good.
If it wasn't for you and Dr. Shock and stuff like that, I mean,
that's what really got the ball rolling. Yeah, that's what really got me to thinking and really doing a lot more looking into a little bit of everything.
That's right. Yeah, yeah. And once you're bitten, you can't stop.
It's like Pandora's box. Once you've cracked it open, it's like now there's no going back.
That's right. Of course, you do lose a lot of friends that way.
But you make some really good ones along the way, too, though.
Well, you do. You do make some good ones, but you also are taught, when you start talking about these things, how conditioned so many people are, how many people don't want to hear. They're just happy with what they've been taught, and they don't want to hear. It's very strange. But a lot of them are not that way. Listen, that Mystery of the Sphinx, the video, I reckon it went around the world. It was probably viewed by at least a few hundred million people over from the various countries. And people remember it, just as you said. Mm-hmm. It's not uncommon. People see it at a certain impressionable age, anything usually from 12 to 20. And it sticks with them. It's suddenly, yeah, we're very proud of that.
And I can go back and watch it again. I enjoy watching it.
Yeah,
I still enjoy it now. Yeah, I still enjoy it now.
Yeah, well, it's you know, I mean, it was not only really popular, it was nominated for an Emmy for Best Documentary of the Year, and I won an Emmy for research. They actually give such an Emmy.
Nice.
Documentaries. So it looks very good on the shelf. Actually, it looks good on the track record. And the shelf, not, I mean, it's a horrible looking, I don't know who the hell designed the thing. It looks like it was designed by Hitler. So the Oscar, too. It's a horrible looking stuff. But it does look good on the track record. So anyway, Kyle and Cam, I will sign off here. And you let me know what kind of feedback you get.
Okay, John, we will. Thank you so much for coming on with us. We love talking with you. Take care of yourself. Bye. And we're back with Expanded Perspectives. Thank you so much, everybody, for listening to that interview. It was really a pleasure to talk to John Anthony West. I'm a huge fan.
It's really kind of like I feel spoiled now. It's almost kind of like I got a gift getting to hang out and talk to John. It was fun on air and off air. And he's just like, you and I laughed whenever we got done interviewing him. He's kind of like a granddad. He's kind of like a grumpy old grandpa. He don't care what you think, what the whole deal is. He is set in his mindset. This is the way it is, and you're going to have to disprove it.
Right. But because of his demeanor, because of his attitude and his mm-hmm. convictions, it's possible for somebody like that to rise up against mainstream archaeology. Yeah. I mean, if he wasn't so stubborn and opinionated, you know, we might have never known that. He was flat out, you know, he was set on, look, dude, there is water erosion on the Sphinx.
This is how it is.
The dates don't make sense to me. And then he got Robert Shock to help him.
Yeah, he's the man that I would say that is responsible for bringing Robert into the fold as far as getting Robert to question, you know, the paradigms and the things that we have today, to really go in there and dig in the books he's written. And, you know, we've spoken to Robert. We're going to be releasing his interview before long. And, I mean, it's great to get to talk to these guys, of people that you've kind of looked up to for years and read stuff about. And, folks, if you like the interview with John, hit it up on YouTube. You can look up and find a bunch of stuff and a bunch of his work. But, yeah, I mean, I want to go on the trip with him to Egypt. I want to do that so bad.
Me too. And on Netflix, if you have Netflix, there's a Mysteries of the Sphinx on there with him on there.
Yeah, if you can't find it there, find it on. And then
I'm sure if you search up whatever the original one was called with Charlton Heston, I'm sure there's
whole versions of it on the internet somewhere.
Yeah, and then he does the Magical Egypt. He has a DVD set, which is unbelievable.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, it's he knows so much about Egypt to just be, you know, what he, it's not a real papered, you know, Egyptologist. The man just is amazing. What do you got for me, brother?
Well, I was going to give a little shout out to a couple people that have been writing reviews. You know, folks, we always appreciate when people write and rate reviews for the show. And if you haven't done it yet, please go ahead and do it. But these are some people I'd like to give some thanks to. Pod Tom, thank you very much. Sticky number 10. Kelly from Ohio. Pimpity Pimp. Ancient Alien 27. Chrissy Peters. Bizmoto. Jay Wyant. Paul S71. And Bill Bixby 56 from Australia. And Jody Bowden from UK somewhere. Thank you so much.
Oh, yeah. It really, it's not, you know, it's not a big deal. But it really helps us. It really helps the show. And to do it like on Stitcher, those, you know, some of those are Stitcher, some of those are iTunes. It really helps no matter where it is. It helps keep us, you know, in the ranks to where we don't just fade into obscurity.
That's right.
I want to give a quick shout out to a birthday to a woman I work with, Lydia. Today's her birthday.
Happy birthday.
On Cinco de Mayo.
Really? That's a great birthday. Yeah.
It is a great birthday, isn't it? Yeah. Uh-huh. Almost like my sister, you know. She's on St. Patrick's Day.
Yeah.
So, I mean.
My godson's on St. Patrick's Day.
Nice. Yeah. So, yeah, those are great birthdays. So, folks, if you're having a birthday, you're having a party, you have anything going on, make sure you be safe. Happy birthday. Happy anniversary. Whatever you got going on. If you got you a new job, congratulations. If you got laid off, hey, more time to do something that you really want to do.
It's an interesting way to look at it. Yeah.
You know, everything goes down like that. Everybody, you know, just thanks for taking the ride with us. Please have a very, very safe week.
That's right, man. Be careful out there. Enjoy your week. Don't work too hard. Tell somebody you love them. Give them a hug.
That's right. Don't get too hot. It's hot down here right now.
It's hot down here.
Here in Texas, it's rocking. So everybody try to stay cool and everybody. And hey, look, you know, everybody got hit by those tornadoes. Please, man, we're thinking about you. We hope everything works out. So we feel you. We understand what that's all about. So, you know, if you had a loved one on there, you know, everybody's praying and thinking about them. So y'all take care, man, and have a great, safe week.
Peace.
West Virginia. West Virginia. West Virginia.